Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here, this podcast, as we're doing every podcast, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. Today, I am proud to have on my show, it's not doctor, right?
It is not doctor.
It's not doctor, okay.
I'm one Latin test away from that.
Okay. Rebecca Bratton Weiss, formerly, as we shall hear, of Franciscan University at Steubenville. I've known her for a number of years. She writes for Patheos, as do I. And I've always been impressed by her Catholic orthodoxy and by her inquiring mind. she thinks like a scholar, and I've got a lot of friends who are. I'm not an academic, but I've always wound up hanging around academics for whatever reason. I've got, I work, or I go to Mass, here in Seattle at, Blessed Sacrament, which is in the university district. And so there's a million academics in my parish. So I recognized an academic when I saw one, in Rebecca. And so I wanted to have her on the show today because she's been the subject of, I think, a grave injustice, multiple injustices, now. And so I thought I'd have her on the show and, ask her to kind of give her side of things. So welcome, Rebecca Bratton Weiss.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's my pleasure to be here talking to you.
So you were, up until recently, you were... Last month, you were teaching at Franciscan University at Steubenville, had super high ratings as a teacher, well spoken of, more recently, you've also been involved in... The new pro-life movement.
That's right.
What is the new pro-life movement to begin with?
You know what? I think it might be your fault that it exists.
Okay. I'm happy
because
with
I think
that.
I think it started. Yeah, I'll just put all the blame on you, Mark.
Okay.
I believe it started based on a Facebook thread.
Okay.
Yes. And I think you kind of jokingly made the remark that that we needed a new pro-life movement. And Matthew Tyson and I started discussing this. And what began as just kind of an exchange of ideas ended up just growing organically. Neither of us kind of set out to be activists. I'm an academic. I'm a writer. I hide in the country and I grow tomatoes. At heart, I'm a curmudgeonly old man.
Okay.
My father was involved in politics and activism, so I think I must have inherited something. It comes out.
Okay.
So we started talking about the need, to reorient the pro-life movement towards a consistent life ethic. And
right.
Basically, when everyone started rah-rahing for Donald Trump as some kind of pro-life hero, a lot of us were sitting back appalled, like, what are we watching?
Mm-hmm.
Now, is this the Twilight Zone?
Mm-hmm.
And I kept waiting. At some point, people are going to stand up and say no. And, you know, and many of the people I know who had long time been Republicans just said, you know, screw this, and decided to turn to the American Solidarity Party. Or many people I know who are longtime pro-lifers voted for Hillary Clinton because they believed that Trump was that much of a menace. The basic principle of the new pro-life movement is that there are reasons why women choose abortion, and simply making abortion illegal isn't going to make abortion go away.
Right.
And it isn't going to make those reasons go away.
Right.
And our defense of life has to be connected then with a much broader understanding of the sanctity of all life. And,
right.
You know, I'm, Matthew Tyson is, I believe, a vegetarian, and I am an eco-grower, an animal rights activist. So, you know, people say, you know, why are you defending these other lives?
Right. So clearly you want to kill babies. I mean, that's the goal. That's the real goal.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. 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 You've outed us. George Soros is paying us.
Yeah. Yes. All that money, it comes pouring in every month. So,
oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. Well, there's actually, I wish I had it in front of me. There's a quote. I'll see if I can find it in a little bit from, Pope John Paul II. Pope Saint John Paul II, by the way, in Evangelium Vitae, which is in fact a teaching document of the Church, an encyclical, the highest, form of teaching document, that the Pope can put out. And, in the course of it, he essentially says that, it is a pillar of the Church's teaching that human life is to be protected from conception to natural death. Which is everything that the new pro-life movement has to say. And
that was what I was brought up to think pro-life meant. Yes.
Right, yes, because you were raised as a Catholic.
Yeah.
And that's what Catholics...
Actually, Jewish, Protestant, and Catholic.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yes.
Uh-huh. And that thereby hangs another tale that we should tell at some point.
Oh, yes.
But, this is just Catholic teaching. That's all it is. And yet to say that these days, is to call your bona fides as a real Catholic into question. Case in point, an article that was just done about, if I can glorify it by calling it an article, it was a real hatchet job, a really nasty hatchet job that was done by LifeSite News. LifeSite News... what can I say? It is the National Enquirer of the pro-life movement. It is a terrible.
Exactly.
It's just a terrible rag. And it spends a huge amount of time not talking about life issues, which is part of the reason that the pro-life movement needs a reboot, is because this is fairly common. We're told, you know, that abortion is, that's the core issue we need to address, you know. Mm-hmm. But LifeSite News spends the bulk of its time attacking Pope Francis, that great enemy of the faith. Mm-hmm. They recently attacked another truly sinister enemy of the faith, Bishop Robert Barron. Bishop Robert Barron somehow or other became their target. And then they banished, Brandon Vaught, who works with Bishop Barron, one of the nicest guys you'd ever meet,
right.
No longer allowed to comment on their site because he too is terribly evil. And now you have joined their august company, as an enemy of the faith.
I know, I'm so pleased.
Yeah. So talk about what, the piece that they ran, give us your side of it.
You know how it is. At some point in this career as Soros paid Pathos bloggers, we are going to be attacked by the far right quasi Catholic.
Just
media.
To clarify.
And I knew it was coming in.
Just to clarify for our listeners, that's a joke. Nobody.
Right.
The whole thing about George Soros paying people is not real. And I can definitely say that it's not real for me.
Sorry.
Not real for you. Where's my more Soros money? I wish I was getting the checks, but I'm not.
I can post pictures of my student loans if you want to see just how not being paid by Soros I am. But, you know, we're going to be attacked by the far right. I just didn't anticipate such a, well, the grown men would have spent so much time and energy stalking me on Facebook and screenshotting snippets of things that I wrote. You know, I'm flattered that they listened to our entire panels of the recent conference I attended at Notre Dame, but I don't think they got anything out of it because
what was this conference that you were at?
Text. It was a great conference. It was called Trying to Say God. And it was basically addressing the fact that as Catholic writers, the secular world sometimes is like, you're talking about God. And then the Catholic world is like, you're talking about God. We want it pretty. We want it sweet. And we're like, actually, we're going to swear a little bit here and we're going to talk about difficult things. And they don't like that. Mm-hmm. They would have hated Graham Greene so much. You know, they wait 50 years until a writer has been like whitewashed and then they're like, oh, we love him. But come on, they would have banned Graham Greene from coming to their schools.
Mm-hmm. And
so it was a great conference.
Thomas Moore had a mouth on him too.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, they all did back then. It was normal.
Yeah.
Pre-Victorian. Yeah, the article, if it was an article, it was more like a pastiche, was just snippets of things I'd written, taken out of context, all of this supposedly to prove that I'm not really pro-life and not really Catholic.
The article seemed to like fall into two. The headline was that somehow you were trying to destroy the pro-life movement by being advocating a consistent life ethic. And so there was like a few paragraphs on that. And then the rest of it was like, she said shit.
Right.
In this, some Facebook comment about something.
I made a vulgar joke on Facebook.
Right.
Like, I'm Catholic. Of course I'm vulgar. I smoke. Yeah. I drink. I swear. I pray.
Uh-huh.
I also dance, but don't tell LifeSite News. it was very poorly written because if this had been turned into me, even by my 13-year-old, I would have said, you don't have a thesis statement. You are rambling all over the place. This is not something that is acceptable for an eighth grade essay, but, LifeSite.
Right.
But yeah, most of it was saying, why is this horrible, disgusting person teaching at Franciscan University of Steubenville?
Mm-hmm.
Although at the time that the article came out, I was no longer teaching at Franciscan University of Steubenville.
And that's the second issue. We'll get to that in a bit.
Okay.
But yeah, so I mean the heart of it. And the core of the claim was, secretly, you favor abortion. Rebecca Bratton Weiss,
apparently,
you support abortion.
No.
Of course not.
I don't. I'm on record. I think it's tragic. I'm pro-life. I am opposed to all killing. Yes. There you go. You've got it.
Okay. But I'm gonna go out on a limb and ask you, do you favor torture?
No, not at all. I think it's really bad.
How about the death penalty? Are you in favor of the death penalty?
Nope.
Yeah.
Not at all.
See,
I don't think it's necessary.
Those wind up being the real issues. Because that's what a consistent life ethic means. Is a consistent life ethic means that you are defending human life from conception to natural death. And the thing is that, a lot of quote unquote, pro-life people support all of that stuff because that's all stuff that good conservatives fight the church.
Right.
In order to continue upholding. And the way it's done is to say, well, all the rest of that, that's a prudential judgment. And prudential judgment is kind of Latinese for you can ignore the church and fight her on all of this.
Right.
Yeah. So
in this case. Yeah.
So there's no, I mean, when this article came out, that was the impression that I was getting from the article, was that your real sin was supporting the whole teaching of the church, and that somehow or other it has become fixed in people's minds that if you support the whole teaching of the church, your real agenda is to support abortion. And I have no idea how that happens, but that's, that seems to be what you're getting at. Which leads to the second thing, because the article, part of the purpose of this article was to not merely attack you, but to attack Franciscan University for employing you. Which was ironic because...
Because I had been unemployed by Franciscan for a month, over a month at the time that came out. I just hadn't said anything about it.
Right.
Partially because I taught there for 11 years as an adjunct, and I started in the philosophy department. And then I kind of segued over to the English literature department, and I loved it. I had wonderful students. My department head, Stephen Lewis, a phenomenal scholar, and I'm very close with his wife. She and he were also attacked in the article for this terrible event that we're planning. It's so evil. It's called the Festival of Friendship. Doesn't that sound bad?
That's awful.
And it's being hosted. I know, it's so awful. And we're doing things like addressing human trafficking and like an exhibit of Millet paintings. We have a whole literary event attached to it. It's very bad. And it's happening in Pittsburgh. It's Synod Hall next to the cathedral, and that's also quite bad. So these people were attacked.
Because the cathedral's allowing this
also
about friendship?
Yes, apparently.
Okay.
Yes, friendship and faith and bad things like that. This is what I loved.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well,
this is what I loved about my work, was that I had these wonderful students, and I had a department head who was someone I respected, and there were certain people in the community that I respected and could work with, and but apparently, as an adjunct, my contract is renewed on a yearly basis, and that's one of the purposes of course evaluations. If the students are all like, she was horrible, then I don't get renewed. My students never said that. They liked me a lot.
Right. Yeah. Your reviews from students were fantastic.
Yeah. And I've maintained great friendships with many of them for years. I even work with, one of my former students is on my editorial team right now for Convivium.
Okay.
Which we should mention is publishing your poem coming out very soon.
So important. This is gonna change American literature forever. Yeah. Talk about Convivium a bit, but then let's get back to what happened.
Yeah. Okay. So, Convivium is a literary arts journal, and I work with Suzanne Lewis editing that, and our vision for it has to do with cutting across these barriers that have been raised between the disciplines, and also between reading that happens in an academic world and reading that happens just every day. Like, the conversations we have about literature need to be brought back to that immediacy, that point of experience, that point of encounter when you see reality and you love it and the Holy Spirit speaks or the muse descends in fire. And so that's what we're aiming for. And so we're trying to bring together, like, my biggest rule when I'm reading something is, am I really enjoying reading this?
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm thinking, well, I'm not enjoying reading this, but it's technically good, then, that's not quite what I'm looking for. I want there to be that sense of pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Our second issue of Convivium will be coming out at the end of this month at our festival. And that's just been a wonderful opportunity. So, you know, even though I'm not teaching anymore, I still get to be working with literature.
Okay.
Poems and things.
So, what happened? Why aren't you teaching anymore?
Apparently, and actually this wasn't a surprise to me. I kind of saw this coming for a while because I knew people were stalking me on Facebook. And I recently found out that this was not the first time that they had tried to pull this off. It's just that they were consistently having trouble finding any real evidence against me. I don't know who they were. Some professors at Franciscan, I have a guess as to who some of them are based on which ones sent me weird messages in the past. And just what views I've seen them expressing, you know, mm-hmm. in comments, the ones who are constantly attacking Pope Francis and constantly praising Donald Trump probably aren't going to like me very much.
Uh-huh.
so I don't know who it was. But they collected, for like 2 years, they meticulously stalked me, like really well-paid, tenured people, instead of spending time with their families and taking vacations and you know, writing poetry and doing good things, were hunched over their keyboards, like screenshotting my Facebook posts. I think that's really lame, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my message to my stalkers. Y'all are lame.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I mean, it's pathetic.
Right.
So they collected evidence against me, and they went to the dean, and they were like, this person is clearly not Catholic or pro-life enough. My department head was kind of liaison between me and the administration, and he basically just explained to me what had happened and said that the dean had said that.
Back up for a second, though. I mean, not Catholic. What point of Catholic teaching do you deny?
None.
Okay.
I mean, there's a flexibility within the teachings to take different interpretations, and you know, some of my interpretations may lean in what would be considered a leftist direction, but I've always maintained a determination to look and see what's written down in the teaching documents of the church and in scripture and in the church fathers, and see, you know, if we're part of a tradition that grows from this, what are the possibilities of this growth?
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be cutting it off. You don't want to be hacking it off.
Well, that's what a Catholic academic does. I mean,
Yeah. Well, it's our job. And, you know, when I was at the University of Dallas, where I was pursuing my doctoral degree, that sort of thing was welcomed. So,
right.
It was a wonderful environment where I learned, you know, robust intellectual discourse, and we read all the texts, all of them. so yeah, like one of the big things that I do that's really bad is like the TV show Game of Thrones, which all of these people are assuring me is porn. They keep telling me that they haven't seen it, but that it's still porn, which is interesting to me.
Okay.
Have you ever read the memoir Reading Lolita in Tehran by Azar Nafisi?
No, I haven't.
She talks about her difficulty in being a professor of literature after the revolution, when a fundamentalist Islamic government took over, and many people who had been faithful Muslims before then are like, whoa, what's happening? Like, this isn't me. The censor who was set up to determine whether or not a film could be acceptable was in fact blind, physically blind. And yes.
Okay.
He couldn't see the movies, but he decided which ones were acceptable. And I just keep being reminded of this with all these people who are like, Game of Thrones is porn. And if they've seen it and they say it's porn, then I don't know what it is that's turning them on.
I had this happen 10 years ago. And by the way, it's the same mm-hmm. sort of dynamic. I've never seen Game of Thrones. Right. I've never read Game of Thrones. Don't care about Game of Thrones, really, to tell you the truth. But, you know, 10 years ago, I mean, and again, it was LifeSite News. Decided that Harry Potter was the gravest threat to the human soul since the beginning of writing, and so, you know, began this, they started misquoting, taking out of context Pope Benedict the 16th, and managed to sort of gin up this panic among good Catholics you know, if you have a good word, if you have a kind word to say about Harry Potter or J.K. Rowling, well, you know, you are, you know, among the heretics. You have rejected the gospel, and et cetera, et cetera. And it was like, seriously, you know, I mean, I've got, like anybody, I've got my criticisms of Harry Potter, but on the whole, I think it's a good series, and I have huge respect for J.K. Rowling. But man, It makes you a marked person, you know, and it still does in some.
It's really hard as a homeschool mom because I homeschool my children, and I, my son has been reading Harry Potter, I think since he was 9. And it's one of those things, you know, he shows up in a public forum carrying his book of Harry Potter, and, you know, some amateur exorcist is going to pop up and start scattering holy water on him. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an actual whole added difficulty because as a homeschooler, I don't like that homeschooling has become this bizarre enclave for essentially anti-education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's supposed to be a space for freedom, not for mind control.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the life sites of this world are very responsible for that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But yeah, very comparable.
Yeah. Well, it comes back to this. One of the things that I've noticed is that in many places in Catholic life, the aesthetic becomes the dogmatic.
Right.
You know,
right.
there are things that you by some magical, you know, transmutation, it's become a dogma with some people that, it, you know, if you happen to have a taste for Game of Thrones or Harry Potter, name your thing, somehow or other, you are in violation of the teaching of the church. You have rejected the teaching. And it's like, no, these are all aesthetic judgments, you know. How did this become a thing? You know? But anyway, so keep going.
Yeah, so that was a big problem, and you know, I was attacked in the article for that, and the people who had been stalking me also attacked me for that. And they pulled my quotations out of context, and it actually bothers me as a literary scholar, the inability that these people have to understand textual analysis. And I don't know which departments they're teaching in, but whatever departments they're teaching in, I'm terrified to think that these people are functioning academics, because it's simply not the way to read a piece of literary criticism. I'm writing popular literary criticism. It's not that hard.
Mm-hmm.
Wait till they see my dissertation. so that was one issue. You know, they didn't like me swearing on a panel, at the Trying to Say God conference. I'm trying to remember. They don't like my reading list. The big thing that they made a fuss about is that I teach Nabokov's novel Lolita. And they seem to think that Lolita is a dirty book, which if they think it's a dirty book, then they must be reading it with the sense that the scenes are presented in a way to arouse desire. And that's really disturbing because it is a book about this systematic rape of a child, and the story is told in such a way as to make you aware of the mind of the abuser. And if you're reading intelligently, you see that Nabokov is exposing the danger of this sentimentality that the protagonist uses when he describes the terrible things that he does in very sentimental terms. He's never vulgar. He's never bawdy. And that's kind of a huge warning signal to me.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about something awful and making it look beautiful. And once you understand that as a reader, you are aware of the danger of this false aesthetics. You're aware that the person who tries to oppress you will then talk about how beautiful it is. Tyranny does this all the time. You know, mm-hmm. the tyrant will always provide an alternative set of facts according to which everything that he's doing is great and lovely. And that's what the novel Lolita teaches you. And I have found when teaching it in class, I always give a trigger warning too, because, you know, you just never know what a reader has suffered before mm-hmm. encountering a text.
Mm-hmm.
But we've had extraordinary conversations in the classroom, and it's given the students the opportunity to talk about the use and the misuse of language to talk about power structures and relationships. And, and by the way, my sister teaches at Harrow School in London, like the one where Lord Byron went and people okay. like that. She teaches the same material that I teach only to 15-year-old boys, and their parents pay I don't even know how much money in order for them to receive this correct education. Mm-hmm. And so this is my idea of looking at a traditional classical education as what I want to offer to my students. But Lolita, that was very bad that I was assigning that. I assigned The God of Small Things, and that was considered to be bad also. Years ago, I assigned a short story in which a sex scene almost happens, and it's really ludicrously described because they're teenagers. Mm-hmm. And like, who wants to read that? And it ends up actually being a story that asserts Catholic morality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, applause to the author because he managed to write this story talking about the power and the sanctity of sex and to have it anthologized in the Norton Anthology, and everyone's reading it. And the only ones who aren't getting it are apparently Catholics, so that's weird. But that was another work that was complained about.
Well, and
of course, this is just ordinary literature.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say it's ironic, of course, because what we're seeing here is there are other kinds of sentimentality than romantic sentimentality, and one of them is pious sentimentality.
Yes.
And the use of pious sentimentality as cover for what was essentially an unjust act, and a power play against you is ironic, to say the least. The reality is you haven't denied a single teaching of the faith.
No.
Nor have you, no. And that includes, of course, the teaching of the faith on the dignity of human life, from conception,
right.
Not merely from conception to birth, but from conception to natural death. And yet for all that, you've been kicked out of your job, and now you're being smeared by LifeSite News. I think it's a tragedy, and the reason for it, so much of it is it comes back to that you don't think Francis is the gravest enemy that the church faces. You're not particularly keen on Donald Trump, and that you've got some, aesthetic differences, with people.
Well, I'm also a feminist, and that's the F word. I have not made any secret of that fact. I participate in discourse with feminists both within and outside of the church. And, that's one of the missions of the new pro-life movement is to kind of build bridges with pro-choice feminists, many of whom aren't all like, yay, abortion's great. Instead, they view abortion as kind of like a necessary evil.
Right.
Something that's unfortunate. They wish it didn't have to happen. And a lot of these people are working really hard to prevent abortions from happening by providing women and families with what we need. And I think that once we open up those lines of discourse, it makes it much easier to talk about the sanctity of the unborn life. There's no longer a threat there. I'm not going to be like, recognize that your unborn child has the dignity of human life. And while you're doing that, I'm going to take away your health care and I'm going to set up a fracking rig in your backyard and you're going to like it.
Right.
And why would anyone want to listen to you when you're doing this?
And I sentence you, and your husband to work three jobs, forever.
Right,
in
right.
order to barely keep bread on the table.
Yes.
Those kinds of things. And this is why the consistent life ethic matter. We both know, a woman, she lives out in New York, she has been astonished in the last year to discover that there is such a thing as Catholics with a consistent life ethic who are not using abortion as a mask in order to, you know, battle for all these obviously right. evil policies, you know. And right. that kind of rapprochement with people who really did not know that there really actually were pro-life people who took seriously, you know, that, yeah, women need health care and families need a sufficient living wage and all the rest of it. That's been a real startling experience for her. And
I know we're talking about the same person. I've had great right. conversations with her.
She's a fantastic really, person, really you know. And it's interesting yeah. because one of the things that you know she's wound up doing as a result, she's an atheist, you know. But one of the things she's wound up doing is like, okay, tell me more, you know. And so I pointed her to here's a book by you know Cardinal Ratzinger, also known as Benedict the 16th, and she's like, I had no idea, and so you know. This is tied up with evangelization as well, and building what Sherry Waddell calls bridges of trust that are the first thing right. that have to be built in order for people to approach the gospel, and that's partly the work that you do in your work with literature.
It was unfortunate. A few years ago, I had a paper accepted at a conference on Irish literature, and I was going to go and talk about the pro-life aesthetics of James Joyce. And I was like, this is going to be interesting because I'm essentially going to go in and present a pro-life statement to a group of scholars who are almost certainly going to be universally secular.
Mm-hmm.
But I was pretty confident about my ability to do it because of going back to what the writer James Joyce presents is essentially a consistent life ethic. I just couldn't go to the conference because I had no money, because when you're an adjunct professor, you don't have any money.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's the irony, you know, is you're doing, you know, essentially you're doing Catholic mission work when you do something like that.
I don't really think of it that way because I fear that if I think of it that way, I'm going to focus on people too much as objects.
Right.
And,
right.
But yeah, it ends up becoming a very communal experience mm-hmm. in which, you know, grace is present.
Yeah.
I'm not in control of grace, but yeah. present.
Well, what troubles me, you know, one of the many things that troubles me about, what's been done to you. Sam Rocha, who is himself a Franciscan grad,
yes.
remarked, I thought very presciently, and I thought it was a very tragic remark. He said, you know, that Franciscan, has gone from being, a place of, Catholic witness to becoming a safe space for, conservative culture war Catholics,
right.
you know. And tragically, you know, this, you know, really attests to that. The reality is
yeah.
you haven't done anything wrong. You haven't done. Why were you yeah. fired? You know.
I did see it coming because I saw the extent to which there was a kind of brand protection going on, and it really had to do with Donald Trump. And it keeps the relationship of Trump, Catholic Trump supporters to Trump reminds me of a girl who's madly in love with a guy who's just a total ass and she refuses to see it. And when her friends say he's an ass, in order for her to protect her illusion, she has to cut off all of her friends from her life.
Right.
It's like that. I saw it begin the day Pope Francis was elected. I said to myself, something very interesting is going to come out of this, and it's either going to be very good with a reorienting of American Catholics towards a Catholic social teaching, or it's going to lead to a schism.
Mm-hmm.
And as usual, my worst case scenario seems to be playing out.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think, and I'm a loud mouth. Anyone who knows me will say Rebecca is really bad about keeping her mouth shut. If there's a sarcastic thing to be said, she's probably going to say it. And I could have seen it coming and checked myself more. And there were two reasons why I didn't. One being that the pay was so crappy. What was the point?
Mm-hmm.
And I needed, you know, in a situation where my scholarly work isn't getting me accolades, instead it's getting me in trouble, you know, I'm obviously not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also just my principle. I have a very classical sense of education. In that respect, I'm a conservative. I was trained in a classical approach to education, actually at Franciscan University.
Mm-hmm.
I did my undergraduate and my master's degree, one of my master's degrees there. And, you know, my undergraduate philosophy advisor encouraged me to ask hard questions. And I said, I want to write my thesis on Nietzsche. And he didn't say, oh, no. Instead, he said, go for it. And I studied in the honors program, and we read the great books of Western civilization. We argued maniacally. And that is what the space of education means. And at the point when I realize I need to censor myself in order to survive, there's a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wasn't going to do that.
Yeah.
Just on principle.
Mm-hmm.
It would not have been doing my job as a human being, really. I saw it coming. And I saw the life site attack coming. I just didn't expect it to be so just crazy.
Yeah, they did exceed expectations.
They did. Congratulations to them.
Well done. But that is the job of a Catholic academic is not to do propaganda. The job of a Catholic academic is to think, and to think with the tradition. And when you're thinking with the tradition, it doesn't mean there are things you must not think about. It means you can think about everything, but you can hold it up to the light of the tradition. When we reach a spot where someone who is disobedient to no precept of Holy Church, who rejects no teaching of Holy Church, is nonetheless, to be not merely, kicked out of a job that she's done well, and gotten high marks for from her students, but also to be smeared like this. Now, to be fair to Franciscan didn't, there's a perception, that a lot of people have,
right,
that somehow Franciscan prompted the smear from LifeSite. They didn't. LifeSite did, in fact, part of the reason for the LifeSite smear was because the real goal was not merely to attack you, but to attack Franciscan.
Right. Although I do suspect that some of the same individuals were behind both,
but
not the institution at all.
And that's part of it is why the
institution doesn't serve.
You know, the gospel reading a couple of weeks ago was, if you're, you know, in this case, your sister, sins against you, then go to them. And then if they won't listen, take a couple of people and go to them. And then, you know, finally, and none of that was done. This is all done, you know, behind your back without your knowledge. And the people, you know, many of the people that are involved in this, we don't even know who they are. They're just people who were capturing screenshots and, you know, writing scurrilous things and putting the darkest possible construction on it. And it's all, none of this is in accord with the faith. You know, this is not how we're supposed to behave as Catholics. So.
No, it's tawdry.
It was tawdry. Where do you go from here? What plans do you have?
Taking martial arts classes.
Well, that seems prudent.
Yeah. And fencing.
Okay.
It's funny because I know that these are people who just kind of like slump over their keyboards and are afraid to see the light of day.
Right.
But in the back of your mind, you start thinking, where are these people going to stop? Like,
right.
You know, I live near them, whoever they are. My children exist in the same community with these people. I don't feel comfortable.
Right.
You know, I spend a lot of time weightlifting. I'm just saying that. Don't mess with me, people. No. In reality.
You do sort of look like Uma Thurman's sister, so I can see you in Kill Bill 3, you know. But,
Yeah, it's a temptation. I have to remind myself I'm a pacifist.
You need one of those Emma Peel cat suits, you know, from...
Oh, my gosh, I totally do. I'll talk to Suzanne with the Revolution of Tenderness and see if we can, like, invest in reconstructing it.
Okay, that sounds good. So anyway, I'm sorry.
Look, So I've got two big things going on, and I'm actually really excited about it. I feel like I will never say everything happens for the best because I'm Jewish, and we know that it doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it seems to be working out that I have revitalized energy in pursuing the work of the new pro-life movement. And this might be of interest to listeners that Matthew Tyson and I are going to be starting a podcast ourselves.
Yes, right here on Breadbox Media.
At the beginning of next month. Yes, we're joining you.
Yes.
We'll have to learn from you and get all of the tips.
Okay.
I'll need the tech tips. I'm terrible, with technology.
I shall be your guide in failure.
We'll be doing the podcast. I would really love to be able to have people start small kind of new pro-life groups, kind of grassroots across the country. I do think that it needs to be political. The work that many pro-lifers have done in providing support for women and families is wonderful and heroic, but we absolutely, simply because of the culture we live in and the economy we live in, we need to promote actual policies that provide health care, that provide housing, mm-hmm. that protect people from unjust business practices. So I really feel strongly about that. So I don't know whether we'll be organizing conferences, a lot to talk about, very exciting. And so stay tuned for more information on the new pro-life movement with Redbox Media.
Very good.
And then I have my work, and I think these two are connected. My work with Revolution of Tenderness, which is largely literary and cultural, because that's where we rediscover what it means to be human and why life is good and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have our upcoming Festival of Friendship in Pittsburgh at the end of September. I have a small literary event on September 29th, The Etymology of Convivium. We'll have speakers on Aristophanes, Charles Williams, Flannery O'Connor. I'm doing a presentation on women writing and community with my poet collaborator, Joanna Penn Cooper. Jessica Messman Griffith of Sick Pilgrim is our keynote speaker. So if you're in the Pittsburgh area, you know, please come join us for this. It's going to be great. And it's just in a beautiful place.
Cool.
Beautiful place, cool, weird people. We'll have to drag you in for one of these at some point, Mark.
Okay.
I know you're on the other side of the country, but
I'll come in and read my one poem. This is my one poem that I wrote. Yeah.
You've written more poems than that.
I don't have.
But yes, our next issue is Condemned to Perfection.
So, but yeah, yeah, I'd be happy.
These are the two things.
All right, good.
Really excited about it.
Are you, yes. any chances that you might wind up, teaching somewhere else, maybe over at, UPID or something like that?
Well, it's hard because I, am one Latin exam away from finishing my PhD. I have two master's degrees, and the academic world is just cutthroat right now. Like, mm-hmm. you need to be 23 with 8 years of experience, and, you know, 50 years of publications and, that's just not possible.
Yeah.
So I loved teaching. I felt it was my vocation. If I can ever do it again, I would do so in a heartbeat. But right now, it's all about the writing. It's about Revolution of Tenderness. And I'm writing two novels, actually three novels right now. The people who hate my nonfiction are really going to hate these novels a lot. And then the new pro-life movement.
All right.
So yeah, I'm excited. I'm going to.
Well, you're a busy bee.
Homeschooling my kids too.
So okay.
Yeah.
Well, you're keeping busy then. You're keeping off the streets, and you know that's important. So.
Right.
And raising tomatoes. So.
And that, actually, that's a damaging thing, though, is that like it bothers me that people will do this and remove a person's livelihood. I mean, the same thing that we saw happening. You know, with you and with Simca, there just doesn't seem to be any concern. What happens to this person after she loses her income? You know, who cares? Luckily, my husband works for a real Catholic who pays a just wage. So,
thanks,
you know, we don't need to go back on the food stamps.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, well, and that is true. There's a brutality and a ruthlessness to this that you know, fortunately in all three of our cases, mine, yours, and Simca's, Providence has stepped in
and
God has been gracious, but it was the thought that counted, you know. And
right, yeah.
So it's troubling, to me to see that kind of thing, and especially to see that thing, those kinds of things done in the name of the faith. But on the other hand, your name has now been joined to that of Pope Francis, Bishop Barron, and Brandon Vaught. one of the four, you know, horsemen of the apocalypse. and that's pretty good company to be in. I figure if you're being ranked with the Pope and Bishop Barron and Brandon, you're doing all right. So.
I'm in great company.
Yes. And I want to thank you, both for your work, for your students, your care for your family, your love for the faith. And I want to thank you for being on the show today, Rebecca. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We've been talking today with Rebecca Bratton Weiss. And where can people go to read your stuff online?
My blog is suspended in her jar at Pathios. So I would recommend going there. And if you're interested in reading my literary work, order an issue of Convivium, where our first issue is available. Our second issue will be available very soon. And you know, I'm in there, but lots of other great people are as well, including Mark in the next one.
Is Convivium online?
And yes, it is. I'm looking. It's at, if you go to revolutionoftenderness.net, Convivium Journal, you can find it there.
Okay.
And you can also find information about our upcoming conference and festival.
Very good. All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show, Rebecca. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back again soon. I'm going to be talking next time with Tony Vicinda. Until then, have a great day. Bye-bye.